For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. A bipartisan measure known as the A-plus plan to raise revenue to fix the budget shortfall doesn't get the needed 76 votes needed to pass. Instead, it fell short with 5 Democrats and 22 Republicans voting against it. The defeat came despite the vote being held open so the GOP could caucus in a back room and lobbying by Governor Fallon. Neva, what happens now?
I think that's a good question. I mean, the governor seems to be intent on continuing to push, and even though we don't know kind of what's going to happen as it finally rolls out through the rest of this week as we're recording this, but bottom line is they could bring it back up for reconsideration. I mean, I think there's some question. I mean, are they 4 votes short or 5 votes short based on the fact that they have the vacant seats that they do? And I think, you know, that's an interesting question. They're close. I mean, the fact that it is bipartisan, that 75% of the Democrats have voted in favor of this bill.
80% of the Democrats.
80%. Over
80%. Yeah. 80%. Okay. Yeah. So I mean, I think it's an interesting scenario. And if this falls apart, I mean, where do they go from here? I mean, I think it just continues to unravel as they try to, you know, deal with all of these situations that keep coming to the forefront, like the health department. And I think that's just going to be the tip of the iceberg.
Ryan.
You know, the Democrats brought 80% of their caucus to the vote on this bill, which is quite extraordinary. Most of the Democrats that voted for this, if not all of the Democrats who voted for this, thought that it was a horrible, horrible bill, but that it was the best that we were going to get, and we needed to do something right now to avert catastrophe for the state of Oklahoma. So you had 80% of the Democratic caucus vote for this. Speaker Charles McCall has been saying all along that he would bring 75% of his caucus to a vote on a bill that came to the floor. He failed to do that yesterday. I think that this is an abysmal failure of leadership and Speaker Charles McCall and not being able to bring enough members of his caucus to bear and pass this bill off the floor yesterday. And I think that it also demonstrates that this entire budget process has really fallen on his shoulders. You've got Senate Republicans and Senate Democrats. You've got House Democrats. You've got the governor. And the one person who can't seem to deliver right now is Charles McCall. It's really got to be a serious crisis of leadership for them. And it's a serious crisis for the people of Oklahoma right now. Neva's right. I mean, this is really what's next. You know, I know that, you know, the governor's saying we need to, you know, maybe bring it back for another vote. That could happen. The number of votes that would be there, who knows? But right now, it's really, really dire for the state of Oklahoma.
Well, and only John Bennett was missing, and I don't think John Bennett would be in yes vote anyway.
No, I think he's in no vote anyways.
But yeah. I do. Governor Fallon says, hey, we'll just keep this special session going till Christmas. Have you ever seen anything like this, Neva?
No, not at all. And I think we have a very beleaguered legislature, I mean, on both sides of the aisle. I mean, it's a situation where, as Ryan says, I mean, no one thought this was a great bill. This was a compromise. It was something that had been thrashed through and fought through. Finally, you know, here was what was on the board to be voted on, and then the votes were not there. There were not enough green lights on the board. And can they come back and prevail on a handful of legislators to change their minds and decide that this is not something that I like at all, but something for the good? If the argument is this the best that we can do right now for the good of the state, or are we going to have this continued really divide among the Republicans of absolutely no taxes, no increases, versus dealing with the problems that are now becoming insurmountable? And it's a very difficult situation. But what I keep coming back to is this is the special session. Folks, you have a regular session coming up in February, March, April, May, and elections in June, August, and November of next year. And if everything is predicated on how this is going to affect an election, that's no way to govern. I mean, so folks either need to step up, figure out what they believe and how they want to vote, or they need to decide that this is not their cup of tea and do something else. But we need lawmakers in there that are going to dig in and dig out, and they've got a big hole. Maybe not of all they're making, but it's on their watch and they're responsible.
I've never seen anything like this. Watching yesterday, I know that a lot of Oklahomans were watching because the live stream on the live stream on the House website kept crashing. We were watching on Facebook. Everybody's watching this. And to watch Republicans and Democrats almost in unison, stand up and say, this is bad, this is terrible, it reflects the situation that we're in right now, it is not a permanent solution, but we need to do this. And then when the vote came down, I was shocked. But you could tell pretty immediately when it got to 70, ultimately had somebody flip at the last minute at 71. I think that may have been a political gimmick to try to create some sort of a partisan narrative. But, you know, whenever it hit 70 and stalled, I think, you know, myself, like a lot of Oklahomans, were just shocked that they didn't get to the point where they could deliver.
And 45 days of special session. I mean, we're talking a long time. 45 days into a special session and no end in sight. I mean, this is. I think you're right, Ryan. I mean, the public is paying attention, and it's not just the handful percentage wise that are actually talking to their legislators. And of course, the governor was saying in her release after the vote that basically, you know, folks, call your legislators, get in contact with them, tell them what you think, trying to kind of step up the dialogue, and hope from her point of view, I'm sure that that some of those votes would come along and change. It's not about pressure. I mean, it's about doing the job, and the job is fixing the immediate problem, and that's something that apparently there's still not the votes there to do, and that's very unfortunate.
And if Speaker McCaul can't get his caucus to do this, maybe they need to think of a new speaker, because at some point you've got to have leadership. And, you know, folks can blame the five Democrats that voted against this. I mean, the fact of the matter is, but for those five Democrats, GPT and some of these other taxes wouldn't even be on the table. But it's really about caucus leadership here. And the Democratic caucus brought more than they needed to the table to pass this. Speaker McCaul has said all along that he could bring 75%. He did not do that yesterday. And so that's the real breaking point right here. It's not Republican or Democrat in a larger sense. It's really institutional. The Senate, the governor, Democrats in the House, and everybody, I think, wanted this deal to happen. And you had a failure in the Republican caucus with the speaker's leadership.
In a press conference, the interim director of the state health department says accounting tricks led the agency to spend more than it was allocated since 2011. Preston Dorflinger says he needs $30 million in supplemental funding just to make payroll by November 29th. Ryan, after Wednesday's vote against the budget plan, it looks like he might not be getting any supplemental.
Right. I mean, and you're looking at a supplemental, and Neva said we're talking, and so that's the supplemental for this fiscal year. Right. That's to get through this year. That's to be able to make payroll at the end of this month, not November 2018 or 2019. This month, for some of the most critical services the people of Oklahoma depend upon, it is unimaginable. And if you have to have a lot of confidence, there can't be a lot of confidence that the legislature is going to deliver here. And then there's an even bigger more serious question of what happens in that 2018 legislative session if you need $30 million right now just to make payroll to get to back to where they need to be. I think a lot of this is the function of agencies, you know, scraping by on fumes for years, trying to perform a variety of accounting tricks to try to just make things meet so that they can continue to look like they're performing the services that they're supposed to, when at the end of the day, what they really needed was revenue, and that just hasn't come in the door. And, everything from this to the Advantage Waiver Program that the Department of Human Services is dealing with, the state just simply needs revenue to provide these services. If you don't have that, you're going to get situations like this, and this is unfortunate and possibly illegal and unconstitutional.
Yeah, right. Aniva?
Well, you have even a bigger issue here. I mean, with the health department, if 60% of your budget, which is what they're saying, actually comes from federal funds, and they have commingled or misappropriated, mismanaged, whatever potentially could be on the board to be looked at, these funds, then they've got a mess that if they think it's just a $30 million payroll problem or a $30 million immediate problem, it's a problem not only that's systemic, it's a problem that the price tag could be triple or quadruple the number that's being talked about, mm-hmm. which is being, those numbers are being thrown around now in the halls at the Capitol. That's something that's going to loom through this entire session. And then, you know, what other agencies get impacted by this? Is it, the other major agencies that we're talking about over and over and over again, which is the Department of Health, Department of Mental Services, the Department of Human Services. I mean, these agencies and the hundreds of millions of dollars that are kind of standing in the stead here of having to be addressed, there's no easy solution. And the governor can call together any commission she wants, and they can begin to kind of look at it from the outside. But until you get people inside You know, and ironically, Preston Dorflinger, I mean, he's dealt with these agencies and dealt with this money, you know, all across the board in his role as Secretary of Finance in the governor's cabinet and at OMES. So it can't be a total shocking surprise to him, some of what is now starting to unravel. And bottom line is, for these 2,600 employees in this particular agency, they're going to have to look at what's going to be done, what can be undone, and what absolutely can be set aside. And that's where the rub comes, is as you start talking about making changes or making cuts, then everybody flies apart because we don't want to make those hard decisions.
And there was talk about canceling the Advantage Waiver Program, and a gentleman by the name of Brady Henderson, who you might know.
Yeah, I know that guy.
I've heard of him.
Says that you can't do that. It's illegal. That's unconstitutional.
Right.
Why is that illegal or unconstitutional on the ACLU's point of view?
You have to give these folks due process. I mean, you can't just take away this just unilaterally without due process. I mean, there are both federal law requirements, federal constitutional requirements, state constitutional requirements that have to be gone through. Mm-hmm. And essentially what happened is 20,000 Oklahomans got a letter that said the services that allow you to stay in your home, to receive services in your home, to keep you out of assisted living centers that are much more expensive for the state of Oklahoma, to keep you out of nursing homes, which are much more expensive for the state of Oklahoma, and don't have the same kind of outcomes as in-home care, that those are going to be cut off December 1. So what we're facing right now, and Neva's right, when she talks about federal dollars being wrapped up at the Department of Health, we're having these outside forces now that are beginning to play into the budget situation, because losing federal dollars at the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, if the ACLU and the Oklahoma Disability Law Center file suit to prevent these waivers from being revoked on December 1, you could end up with a federal court order that says the state has to fund this. So there are these forces that could come to bear that could make the budget situation even worse. But I think that that's a reflection of how dire the situation is. When we were looking at this at our Brady Henderson, legal director at the ACLU of Oklahoma, when we were looking at this, you know, this case is literally life or death for 20,000 plus Oklahomans. And, you know, our partners at the Disability Law Center see it the same way. And with the Department of Health, the decisions that are made there are life and death for a lot of Oklahomans. You know, this is not child's play anymore, and we really need some leadership.
One of the issues brought up several times in questions and debate over the budget plan on Wednesday was news from national credit rating agency Moody's that the use of one-time funds and the inability to raise revenue could result in a lower credit rating for the state. Neva, is this concerning to you?
Absolutely. I mean, it's another warning from Wall Street, basically, that's saying that Oklahoma's on the radar. Oklahoma have issues that ultimately could have tremendous impact in terms of our ability to make for debt financing to become much more expensive, much more difficult, and how that plays in the bigger picture. Again, all of these things have implications because they're also intertwined. I mean, if we want to talk about growing the economy, if we want to talk about bringing, you know, businesses in from other states, if we want to talk about all of the things to incentivize and do all of these proactive things on the commerce side, that's hard to do when you have these kind of statements being made and this tone being directed toward the state overall. I mean, it doesn't make it attractive. So I think the warning sign is, okay, step up and address this as opposed to just wait for the hammer to fall. And that's where all of this becomes so intricate and so incumbent upon the legislature to actually begin to address it in a bigger, broader way rather than just reactionary and making it so partisan driven. The public want things fixed. What they're willing to do in terms of what the price tag to that is, I don't think we know yet, because we haven't really given them a clear picture of what we want to do and how we want to do it long term to move the state forward.
Right.
You look at what Moody said. They said we've got a structural budget deficit. They said we're relying too much on one-time monies, you know, accounting gimmicks, moving cash from cash reserves to plug holes that should be plugged with recurring revenue sources. They basically outline, they give us a blueprint of everything that's wrong with the way that we're trying to finance state government in Oklahoma, including our ability to finance our debt obligations and our bonds.
And they did criticize the Constitution. I mean, the fact that the stringent rules that are in place. I mean, that's an important point that I think is going to become probably a bigger dialogue point in the upcoming session and moving forward, because it's something that has to be looked at. Whether or not it's addressed or changed, it at least has to have the prospect of being fully discussed and see whether there's a new direction the state wants to go ultimately.
Absolutely. State Question 640, which amended our Constitution, that 76-vote requirement that we had in the Oklahoma House yesterday, is a direct result of that constitutional requirement from State Question 640. You know, it's pretty amazing that we've got a political process in the state of Oklahoma. I think it was Phil Bachrach who said this on Twitter the other day. He said, we've got this process in Oklahoma where you have a majority of Oklahomans who want a revenue increase, want to be able to fund these services, want to get out of the special session. A majority, a huge majority of the legislature, but not a super majority of the legislature, who also want that. And so that 76-vote requirement is a structural problem. Moody's pointed that out. We have to do something. We want to be a business-friendly state, but I tell you what, it's going to take a lot more than relatively low housing prices and a couple of really nice coffee shops if we're going to keep this deal rolling. Because if we've got homelessness, if we've got people dying in the snow and the ice over the winter because they were kicked out of their homes and couldn't afford to go into a nursing home or adult services, that's where our state's headed right now. We're not recruiting businesses like that.
Or bonding when we're talking about roads and bridges.
Long-term infrastructure projects. Right. Yeah.
Oklahoma City makes changes to its panhandling ordinance. New rules passed by the city council bans panhandling only in intersection where roads are posted at 40 miles an hour or faster. This was done to answer a legal challenge by the ACLU of Oklahoma. So, Ryan, does this amendment go far enough?
The amendment doesn't go far enough at all. The litigation will continue. We're going to continue to fight for the First Amendment rights of our numerous plaintiffs in this case, who range from media organizations to people that panhandle as a way to supplement their ability to exist on this planet. The pretext of all of this that the city council is telling everyone and that the city's legal team is telling everyone is that it's public safety. And that is just absolute hogwash. It's laughable for them to sit and talk about public safety. The numbers don't bear it out. The studies don't bear it out. When you begin to really question city officials about this, it's not there. It's an illusion. What this is really about and what it's always been about is about the city's effort to sweep poverty under the rug, to try to take, as we're becoming a big league city, to take the poverty and the homelessness that exist in our city and put it out of sight and out of mind. If we really want to do something for public safety, that we'd stop monkeying around with this. They would repeal that provision to begin with. We'd get rid of this costly litigation before it gets even more costly. The price tag's already up there, but it'll become even more costly. Let's invest in some sidewalks, some protected bike lanes. I'll walk my kid to school in a neighborhood school, and I got to walk in the middle of the street because we don't have any sidewalks. To me, that's a heck of a lot more dangerous than worrying about folks panhandling in a median.
Neva.
I think the key point that Ryan makes is the cost of this litigation. I mean, the council needs to take that into account. I mean, it's one thing to dig in and have a point of view. It's another once it gets to the courthouse and litigation and having to address it from that standpoint, just for taxpayer dollars. I mean, we can't find ourselves in these communities, just like in the state, just like in the counties, if everything is just going to be hung up in litigation and we're going to spend tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars, trying to see which side's going to ultimately prevail. That's not good governing. I mean, it's about finding solutions. Are there better ways? I mean, are these 103 medians that basically we're talking about across the city of Oklahoma City for these where these panhandlers have spent most of their time, I mean, in terms of the areas that have been pinpointed, is there another way to address this? Is there a way to come up with a compromise? Is there a way to deal with this that gets it handled and gets it off everyone's plate? I think that's the point. I mean, rather than dragging it on indefinitely through litigation that serves no good purpose, if in fact the council can make a good decision that moves it forward and is best for the city.
The thorn in the side of justice reform advocates resigns his position in the state house. Chickasha Republican Representative Scott Biggs is taking a job with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Governor Fallon has already set a special election and filing starts next week. Neva, Biggs was a big part in single-handedly stopping criminal justice reform measures pushed by Governor Fallon and others.
And I think here's a classic case in a new administration of folks like Scott Biggs, who become, you know, kind of a natural person that rolls into these federal positions. And, you know, in this instance, the state executive director for USDA is a significant post. I mean, it's a major federal appointment, certainly something from the state standpoint that puts him in a very strong position in dealing with the agriculture all across the state. He has a background. I mean, his undergraduate degree in agricultural economics and then a law degree, I mean, and his time in the legislature put him well positioned to be someone who was going to be seriously looked at for an appointment if he was interested, and clearly he was. So it was a rapid departure, and I think the governor moved quickly, which I applaud her for, to try to make this special happen so that hopefully we get someone for this district in place and to be able to represent those folks in the upcoming session.
It was really surprising how quickly she
There is a window there. They can move much more quickly than sometimes they do to set those dates. And I think in this instance, trying to get someone on the ground and in the position in advance of this upcoming session is important.
Sure. Ryan?
The Biggs question here.
The Biggs question. Yes.
It begs the question?
Yeah,
Biggs
Okay. Dad jokes. Mm-hmm. The Biggs question here is what this means for criminal justice reform moving forward in the Oklahoma legislature. You know, there for this entire session, you know, and I've been one of his chief antagonists as the roadblock, or as a roadblock for criminal justice reform in the legislature. The real question is, what does this mean? I think that what we're going to see is that Biggs was just part of the problem. He wasn't the problem. He was a mouthpiece for the district attorneys, for the District Attorneys Association, and for other organizations that wanted to do everything they could do to defend an indefensible status quo. And he was enabled in the legislature by Speaker Charles McCall. You know, Speaker Charles McCall could have at any point listened to the voters of Oklahoma, nearly 60% of whom voted for state questions 780 and 781. He could have listened to the governor. He could have listened to the Senate. He could have listened to the majority in the legislature itself and removed him from a committee chair position that gave him the gatekeeper role over criminal justice reform measures. He did not do that. And so, you know, one of the things that I'm going to be watching for is who becomes the new mouthpiece for the District Attorneys Association? Who's going to begin to carry water for this broken, indefensible criminal justice system that we have in Oklahoma?
Right. And now the Biggs replacement in the legislature will not be the next chairman of the
McCall will select.
So, well, because there won't even be anyone in there.
Yeah.
So McCall will select. So it's a matter of just seeing who the next person is and how they react to criminal justice bills that are going to go, to be in his committee.
Yeah, obviously, and I think that's going to be an interesting watch to see who that person is. And you're right. I mean, this is again one of these big debates, these big discussion points that is going to go on through this upcoming session. I mean, there's already legislation that's in the pipeline. There's a lot of discussion, a lot of push, both from not only inside the chambers but certainly around the state at large, with many groups that are focused on making this a central debate point, and not only in the session, but I think in the upcoming elections, where I think we'll see much more focus, because the district attorneys across Oklahoma will be either up for re-election or there will be elections in those districts. So it will be an interesting time.
Every DA is eligible for re-election in 2018 in the state of Oklahoma. That's going to be a big referendum, I think, on where DAs are at and their role in the political process. And you know, Neve is right. You know, we need to, I think that people that have been interested in reform, you know, this has, you know, brought together one of the most diverse ideological coalitions in the state's history, this push behind criminal justice reform. And
both folks from the right and the left.
Right and the left. You know, everybody's sitting at the same table who are trying to make this happen for a variety of reasons, but we all have a lot of common goals at the end of the day. And when we see who McCall puts in that position, you know, as reformers, we can celebrate, you know, good riddance to a key obstructionist to criminal justice reform measures. But a lot of it's going to come down to who this appointment is, and we'll get a sense of what Speaker McCall's real commitment to this issue is by who he appoints to that role.
And of course, that's all coming up in the regular session. We still got to get through the special session. So, Ryan and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.